Welcome to the Tennis Worthy podcast, coming to you from Melbourne Park, where we have just seen the crowning of Carlos Alcaraz, the youngest ever male player to do the career Grand Slam. I'm Chris Bowers. Alongside me are Patrick McEnroe, the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and Jill Krabus, former fourth round player at Wimbledon and player of 49 Grand Slam main draw singles. First reactions, Patrick. Remarkable achievement for a 22-year-old, by far the youngest, beating Don Budge's record that stood since 1938 when he won the French to complete his career Grand Slam. He went on to do the pure Canadian Grand Slam. And younger than Nadal, younger than Federer, younger than Djokovic, younger than Agassi. Remarkable achievement.
Yes, my brother reminded me that a couple of times, that it was Don Budge, because Don Budge used to give John advice when John was first coming up. So that was cool to have that memory. I wasn't surprised, really, with how the match played out, because I felt that Alcaraz was going to be able to use his variety, use his ability to change the tempo. You know, Novak came out and was on fire in the first set. But Alcaraz was kind of giving him what he wanted. He was hitting the ball pretty flat, pretty hard, which was similar to what Sinner did in that semifinal. But Alcaraz was very quick to realize, with a little help from his coaching team, they were under the gun because Juan Carlos Ferrero was the first time he wasn't there, or at least first time as his regular coach, because he wasn't here last year, got him to change the trajectory of his shots. And in fact, his average height of his forehand over the net went up considerably after the first set. And I think that just the way he was able to change the tempo kind of changed the way the match was played. But still, it was an awesome match. It could have been an epic match if it had gone five. I thought Djokovic played his butt off, played extremely well, played about as well as I thought he could play, especially after the five-set win over Sinner. So certainly Alcaraz well-deserving, and the fact that he's done this all at 22 and has seven majors, pretty scary.
Jill, your comments on the match and on Alcaraz with the career Grand Slam at 22.
Yeah, I think it's incredible that he's been able to do it so young. I mean, there was so much hype on him from such a young age, and the fact that he's been able to perform consistently at such a high level. I mean, I think he's got one of the best games. I think Patrick summed it up perfectly, because in the first set, he was trying to go toe-to-toe with Djokovic, which is exactly what he wanted. I mean, Djokovic streamlined consistently against Sinner, and it worked. And I think we knew that Carlos was going to be able to mix it up. It was a little bit like how Musetti was able to mix it up quite a bit against Djokovic, and he was up two sets to love before he had to retire. And so I felt like it was going to be a difficult challenge for Djokovic. I'm not surprised that he tested him, because I felt like the way Sinner and Alcaraz have been playing, it's crazy, because they almost pushed Djokovic to have to go to another level, which is what Djokovic did to everybody else at one point in his career. But I felt like he actually learned different things from these two young guys about using the drop shot, now the surprise tactic of serve and volley occasionally today. So it was interesting to watch, but I love the respect they had for each other. I mean, it was so genuine in the post-match interview. You could see it in their faces, how much respect they have, how appreciative they were, because they knew it was such an amazing final. It was a privilege to watch.
Patrick, you mentioned the advice that Alcaraz got from his coaching team. I mean, he won just 2 points in the first set off the Djokovic serve. Was that turnaround all to do with the advice, or did Djokovic's level drop off a little bit after the first set?
Well, I don't think it was really to do with the advice as much as the talent of Alcaraz and his ability to problem solve. You know, he's never been a great returner. Now, that's something he's still a little inconsistent at. So that showed up. Interesting, though, Novak didn't have that many aces, even though he served at a high percentage. It's hard to get the ball past Carlos. And I think what Carlos did was he stepped back on the return of serve, so he gave himself a little more time. That enabled him to, A, get more returns in play, and I think more importantly, play with more trajectory off the return and get the ball up and get the ball out of, as Jill rightly said, you know, the ball, if it was in Novak's strike zone, he was going to go for it, because he knew that was his only real chance. He didn't want to get into – it's ironic, isn't it, that he'd want to get into a running war, which is what he used to do to everybody else, make you suffer, make you cover the court. And, you know, Alcaraz is able to play the slice. I knew he'd start to play the drop shot, which he did, and that kind of opened up the rest of his arsenal. And it is amazing to watch him. We were talking about this just before we started. you know, he comes out there, Alcaraz, and we're in our little bunker, you know, right behind the one baseline. And every match we've called, my brother and I, and today we were joined by Chris Fowler, he comes over to the window. And he just laughs and he looks at us and he smiles. And he didn't do that as much in this match, but he did it twice. He did it once when he was down early in the second set, as if to say, like, hey, this guy's playing good. What am I going to do to turn this around? And then he did it right before the last game of the match at 5-6. He came right over. And I'm like, how can this guy do that in front of with all this going on? And it's almost like he's having a little chat with us.
But that's one-way glass. Does he definitely know it's you there?
Oh, he knows it's us for sure. Yeah, he can see because he leans down and he knows exactly who it is. So one time John was reading his notes. This was on a previous match. And he had played this amazing volley. So I'm pretty sure he wants to see John's reaction. He doesn't really care about mine. So John didn't see him. And I said, John, I had to tap him. I said, he's looking at you. Come on. He wanted John to smile. Look at that drop volley I hit.
Did John smile?
Oh, he sure did. He loves it. Yeah, he loves it.
Now, Jill, you're in the next booth, so very close. Did you see much of Alcaraz's interchange, sort of non-verbal interchange with the McEnroe brothers?
I was knocking on the door saying, hey, smile at us. No, we saw it every time. It was amazing to watch, and I saw it in that last game, too. And I was like, how can he do that and, like, still keep his concentration and focus? But we know how much he smiles during matches. He feeds off that. He feeds off the crowd. You get a sense that you know, okay, he's in a really good place when he starts giving that smile. But he does a couple different smiles. There's like a smirk where he looks like a little still unsettled or unsure, but that was a confident smile, and he did it a few times. But that last game was so intriguing because I was like, how can he do that and just then be able to focus? And you just got a sense, like, I'm like, he's probably going to break now or whatever that game was.
So what does it tell you about Carlos, the fact that he can do that? Or does he need that to take away the pressure of being constantly focusing?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I feel like he loves the challenge. I mean, he just loves being able to be in that moment. I mean, you can feel it in him where he gets the crowd involved. I mean, it was kind of interesting watching them both trying to get the crowd involved. And I felt like that was a big difference between the Sinner match and this match, because Sinner's not going to do that with the crowd. And I really feel like in that encounter, Djokovic, like, fed off that even more because he knows Sinner's not going to engage at all. But I knew Alcaraz was going to do that today. And so right from the beginning of the match, I was like, that's going to be interesting if the crowd gets involved, because Carlos is going to give it right back. And it helps both of them, and it helped him. But I think someone like – and Novak is the same. I think they just love being able to be in that moment where they take that challenge on.
One of Novak's favorite lines last year was – that Alcaraz and Sinner have taken the game to new levels and he's now chasing them. Obviously, he's added things to his game. But where do you think this victory for Alcaraz leaves the development of tennis? What are you seeing, Patrick, that's come in to tennis that perhaps gives us an indication about how the sport will be played 3, 4, 5 years from now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think we're trying to teach our kids at our tennis academy in New York, like, some of these crazy shots. We should think they were crazy. You know, playing a drop shot on your back foot, playing a short angle. We saw Boris Becker start to do that quite a bit. But Alcaraz is sort of making things that you didn't think possible now seem possible. And he hit one forehand when he was kind of off his back foot from the middle of the court that dipped down, you know, like a cross-court angle that was dropped well inside the service box. And you're like, how did he even create that angle? I think he slightly mishit it. But it is remarkable. And I just want to point out one other thing about his team, because they were under the gun a little bit with Ferrero not being there for the first time as the main coach. And I think in the semifinals, I think they helped him a lot, because when he was struggling with the cramps and when Zverev was coming back and he was trying to stay calm, they kept telling him to stay calm, to relax. And then at one point late in the match, they said to him, smile. You know, smile, enjoy yourself. More to what Jill was just talking about, too, that he loves to engage. And they also know, as to your point and your question, that he plays better when he's enjoying himself, when he's enjoying the moment. It's hard to enjoy it when you're cramping and it's brutal heat, but they kind of reminded him of that. And look, that got him through. That helped him get through that match in the semifinals, that he could be there for a chance to win his first Australian Open title. So we got to see history tonight. We got to see Djokovic get his first plate He looked at that thing. He's like, what is this? I've won it. I'm 10-0 here coming into this one tonight. Well, now he's 10-1. But I just saw him, actually, as I was coming in. We were coming in to do this podcast. And he was walking in, and I gave him, and told him congrats. I mean, I really thought it was one of his great moments in his career, and we know about his career, to do what he's done the last 3 days. Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I feel like it's the hardest I've ever seen Djokovic hit the ball, and he kind of had to, which is what we've been pointing. And it's amazing because I don't know if a lot of people would have thought he would have gotten to another final. That's kind of been the talk in the last couple of years, and he's proved everyone wrong. So it is an amazing achievement to be able to accomplish and get to the final again here.
His speech in the ceremony talked about 6 months. A year, it's impossible to say, but it's been a great ride. That was not necessarily a valedictory speech, but keeps open the fact that he may quit at some stage this year. It also indicates that he still thinks he's got a chance at Wimbledon. Do you?
Yes, I think so. I don't think you can predict what's going to happen. You have no idea. Like at his age, I mean, he's been speaking about how much longer it takes for his body to recover now. I mean, it was very physical these 2 weeks. And so I feel like you never know what's going to happen. I think he probably said those words just in case it doesn't happen next year. He wanted to address like all the supporters in the crowd out there because, yes, he may be back next year, but he has no idea. I mean, none of us have any idea what's going to happen in these next 12 months. So I felt like he wanted to say something, but who knows? He could be back for 3 more years.
Patrick?
Well, I think if he plays the way he played in these 2 matches here, he could win Wimbledon, right? So I think that's going to be in his mind. The other thing I think to Jill's point is that I think he realizes how kind of far he had to push himself and to get out of his comfort zone a little bit with not only his game, but just, you know, physically. I mean, we've seen him do it before. So you wonder if he's just kind of – at some point he's going to get to that point where he's like, I just don't want to do it anymore. You know, he can still do it. But I think with the way that he played and as well as he played, and he – you know, remember, not only did he beat Sinner, but he played a very competitive match in this final. Very competitive, more so than he played last year in any of his semifinals. You know, he didn't win a set in any of them. So if you look at it from that perspective, he's playing better now. Now, can he keep that up, and can he play enough over the course of the next 4 or 5 months to be ready at Wimbledon? But if he can play that brand of tennis that we just saw him play in the last 9 sets he played, certainly he could win Wimbledon again.
I'd like to come back to Djokovic, Alcaraz final, but let's just – before we do that, talk a little bit about the women's event, which seemed very open. And yet, the further it went on, it seemed to be Aryna Sabalenka's. And yet, she ended up not only losing the final, but she lost it from 3 love up in the final set against Elena Rybakina. And she's now 4-4 in Grand Slam finals. So she's clearly a deserved and clear world number one. But she hasn't got the aura that previous people have had in Grand Slam finals.
No, you don't think so? I think so. I think she has the aura still. I think she presents herself very well. I think she handled herself. I know she's been working on like handling her emotions quite a bit, which has improved significantly over the last few years. We've spoken about it. And I even think today there was an improvement. I mean, I think – or yesterday in the final. And I think I thought, yeah, even being up 3 love, I felt like Rybakina did kind of pull back a little bit. She didn't have as quite as much depth and pace on the ball in the beginning of the third set. And then I felt like she flipped a switch and out of nowhere went back to how she started the match in the beginning. And then it took a little while for Sabalenka to adapt and adjust to that. But I don't think anyone is like super surprised Rybakina won. I think she finished the year incredibly well, winning the WTA finals. She beat Sabalenka there pretty handedly. And that was indoors. I know that's like a little altitude, so that feeds into Rybakina a little bit. But you have to give a lot of credit to Rybakina because throughout the quarterfinals and semis, her serve was like first serve percentage, I think, was below 50%, but she somehow managed to come through. And that shows that it's not just about her serve; it's about her competitiveness, her willingness to stay in every single point. And she came up with big serves at the end to close that match out. So I feel like she's going to win multiple more slams. I think she has the game for it. But I do feel like Sabalenka still has that presence and aura about her.
Patrick, It's a second Grand Slam singles title for Rybakina, two different places, different surfaces. Does that elevate her to a different position even at this early in her career?
Definitely. Can you say Hall of Fame? Like, you know,
possibly.
I was thinking that actually once you've won two slams,
usually,
you are very much in the frame.
Yeah, very much in the frame. I think that she's too good of a player to not have won. You know, in other words, I feel like she deserves a second major because to Jill's point, I mean, she had a great head-to-head against Sabalenka coming into this match. She's great head-to-head against Iga Swiatek. She's a great player. You know, and I think she's underachieved in the majors more than the fact that, you know, Sabalenka, she's there. I mean, I think Sabalenka does have some aura about her. I wouldn't say she has the kind of game that's just utterly dominant. You know, there's still players that can beat her. She's not like a Steffi Graf or a Serena Williams. She's a great player, but she's number one in the world. She deserves to be number one, but she's not that far ahead of Rybakina, of Swiatek, and you know, a few of the others. But she's old. She's darn consistent, and she played herself into a position where she had a chance. But I was glad for Rybakina because I said I think she's. You know, I love her. You know, she doesn't show you too much. At least she smiled a little more when she won this. When she won Wimbledon, it was like she didn't do anything. But I think it meant a lot to her because I think she's been through some tough times. She's had some moments where she didn't deliver. You know, she had some injuries, some illness. So I was happy to see her win her second major. Well-deserved.
Jill, do you think that Sabalenka and Rybakina could become the rivalry at the top of women's tennis?
I think it could, yes. I mean, you still have Swiatek in there, and then there's, you know, obviously Keys and Pegula, but I know they don't have as much as the consistency as those. But yes, I think it could be. There are two that have the biggest games, I think, as far as pace and serves. And
I mean, you mentioned Swiatek there. She had a poor Australian season. She emerges with a title because Poland won the United Cup, but she lost her last two singles against Goff and Bencic and didn't seem to be comfortable on the Australian hard courts.
Yeah, it's been interesting watching her lately because we know the intensity that she consistently brings, but I almost feel like it's becoming a little stress, like where she's like, there's holding on to so much tension. And I know she plays like that. I mean, she plays with that intensity all the time. And I would just love her to kind of occasionally relax. I feel like because sometimes it goes against her where all of a sudden, because there were quite a few matches where she won the first set easily, but then lost the next set easily. And I just feel like there's this massive amount of tension that I just want to say, okay, it's okay. Like, just relax a little bit. But having said that, that's what has gotten her to the top in the past. But I still think, you know, the serve is a work in progress. Now all these other women are coming out with massive serves, and I know she's been working on that with the placement and stuff like that. But look, I mean, she's an amazing competitor. She's been number one for a long time, and I still think she has that determination to get back to winning slams.
It's just she hasn't sort of pressed on since Wimbledon. That many of us thought that would be the point where she would just say, right, okay, I've won on all three surfaces now. This is my time. But it hasn't happened.
Well, I think we have to remember that it's how difficult it is to keep that consistency. And there's so many good players. The depth of the women's game is outstanding. And I think we forget how hard it is to, like, win a slam. I mean, we were so used to seeing Djokovic and Nadal and Federer dominate. And I think we forget because of that how hard it is in these 2 weeks to get to that stage to win a slam. And so I think we have to remind ourselves of that.
And Patrick, just a word about the American women, some of whom you've very much encouraged on their journey to the top. There were three players who looked very well set, Anisimova, Pegula, and Goff, until Goff had that shocker, just a terrible day. Is American women's tennis in good shape, or is there still something missing that will take, well, Goff has two Grand Slam titles already, but Anisimova and Pegula just to that extra level?
Well, there's no Serena, so that we know, and there never will be another one. But I think we as an American women's tennis are pretty darn good shape. I mean, four in the top 10 on off keys will drop out after losing her points here. But, you know, Pegula's rock solid. Can she win a major? I mean, I think she can, but it's not going to be easy with her just style and, you know, with the two big hitters out there. I think Coco's got to you know, got to find a way to get more consistent. That was very disappointing here. But, you know, she's a great athlete. She's a great competitor. And there's other, you know, Iva Jovic I thought was incredible. I thought she had a great tournament. I love her spunk. I love her attitude. I think Anna Samova will win a major. I think she's got a good chance to do that this year. She can play on every surface. And just about Iga, you know, I think Iga, I agree with Jill, she needs to, like, chill out a little bit. But that being said, she's still probably the best clay court player in the world, you know. So to say that it's going to be a two-women race between Sabalenka and Rybakina, I think, you know, forgets about her. And remember, she did win Wimbledon. So, but I agree that she should be – it's hard, right, to find that balance of kind of not – being so intense that you can still go, you know, relax a little bit. And I think she hasn't found the balance myself of playing more defensive style at times because she's so quick. She plays with a lot of spin, which is unusual for a woman to play that much topspin. And I think she just relies on trying to play offense all the time. I've never figured out why she doesn't sometimes just sit back, you know, like Novak Djokovic did in his prime and say, I'm going to make a million balls. You're going to have to beat me. You're going to have to, you know, I'm going to run you around. But she hasn't found that balance. But I think the American women plus some of these younger ones coming up, there's nobody that's going to dominate, but I don't think there's anybody in – I don't even think Sabalenka is going to dominate, you know, the women's game. I think she's going to be right there in the mix, but I think there's going to be three, four, possibly five women that can win majors this year.
Okay, let's just finish with a historical note here. We've had the final between Alcaraz and Djokovic, which was the second largest age gap. Mm. The largest age gap was Connors playing Rosewall. Mm. 17 years and a few days, as opposed to 16 right. years between Alcaraz and Djokovic. When you look back to Connors having crushed Rosewall in that 1974 Wimbledon final, that clearly made Connors' reputation. But Rosewall's was also enhanced by reaching not just that final, but he reached the US Open final a couple of months later. And in fact, he had a very, very long five-set final to reach the final of Wimbledon in 74, just as Djokovic did with his victory over Sinner. Has just getting to the final and taking Alcaraz to four sets enhanced Djokovic's long-term standing? We've talked a lot about Alcaraz doing the career slam, but where has this left the standing of both men in a historical context? Difficult question because we're answering it immediately after it's happened. But what do you think?
Not difficult at all. It's enhanced Djokovic's big time, you know, because I think it was just, to me, one of the most impressive performances he's ever had. To do what he did, to see how these other two players, Sinner and Alcaraz, have changed the tempo of the game in the last couple of years, and to go back and figure out a way for him to beat one of them and compete with the other one in best of five, I think is one of his most remarkable achievements. And I'm saying that about a guy who's the greatest of all time. He's won 24 majors. So that's to me, that's high praise for him, which is well-deserved. And Alcaraz is scratching the surface of what's possible. This guy can do it all. He can literally play any shot that you could imagine and then some. And what he showed here, which he showed before, but he showed it especially in the semis, was his determination and his grit, you know, to fight through some difficult moments. And I think, as he said in the trophy presentation, you know, he's been watching Djokovic for all these years and watching a guy who was sitting in the first row, Mr. Rafael Nadal, what those guys did, I think that's made him a better player and a better competitor.
Jill, how do you feel that this is altered Djokovic's standing? I mean, he has clearly developed his game. Is that going to help in the historical assessment of him, even though he lost this particular final?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Like, I think I touched on it earlier, how he loves learning. And I think he's one of the ones that broke through the Nadal-Federer dominance when he was coming up, which is impressive on its own, right? I mean, they were so admired. Everyone, I love the all three of them, how they all three have complete contrast of styles too. And I really think having those three at the top continue to push each other to do better, because Nadal's style is completely different from Federer, completely different from Djokovic. And the fact that they constantly competed against each other just made them better players to learn new skills, to develop new tools. And I think we witnessed it again here. He knew he had to do something different against Sinner in the semifinals. Sinner again fed into exactly the way he wanted to play. But I was sitting courtside, like in the beginning of that match, and right at the first game, the way Djokovic annihilated the ball, and I was like, I've never seen him hit the ball that hard. And I watched the whole match but he had to come out of his comfort zone. And then the first thought is, can he keep this up for 3 hours? Well, he did. He kept it up, and it was
4 hours.
For 4 hours, and it was incredible. And we almost felt like, okay, you have to do that again against someone who plays completely different. And can you do that? And again, he proved that he could compete at the highest level and adjust to something that Alcaraz brought. Okay, he didn't win, but he still showed how well that he could play and still bring that level that he brought against Sinner.
Well, Djokovic said at the trophy ceremony that he and Alcaraz will see each other on court for another 10 years. I don't think that's going to happen somehow, but it'll be amazing to see what Alcaraz goes on to do. He's 22 years old. He's won all four majors, and he seems to be getting better and better. My thanks to Patrick McEnroe and to Jill Krabers. This has been the Tennis Worthy podcast from Melbourne Park. I'm Chris Bowers. Don't forget to tune in to more Tennis Worthy podcasts at tennisfamed.com/podcast. From me, it's goodbye.